Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Thursday, join us for a personal tour of Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S., a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brook and attorney at law Alan Phillips. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts and questions. Let's go!
I'm Debbie Brook, founder of Homeopathy World Community. I'm speaking with our co-host, Alan Phillips, attorney at law. Today is May 19th, 2011. We kind of have a new theme. It's called Autism and Vaccinations, The Plot Thickens. Thank you to our listeners. I know that many people do listen and make their life decisions based on expert guidance, so I encourage you to give Alan a call. He knows what's happening in the vaccination arena today. They have. We also appreciate everyone who listens to the show, who favorites it, becomes a friend, puts reminders on their emails, and shares via Twitter, Facebook, StumbleUpon, Dig, Google Alerts, anything that you do to help other people learn about the Blog Talk Radio show, Vaccinations and Your Rights in the United States. For those people who are new to Blog Talk Radio, you can find the chat right below the announcement page on the internet. We do welcome your comments and questions during the show, and we will try to respond to them and speak of them on air. Those people who have informed us of their identity ahead of time and the purpose of your call can even call in. So I really appreciate everyone who does listen to the archives. Our numbers are always growing. If you listen at your convenience on your computer, iTunes, iPod, or cell phone, let other people know about the show. Today we are going to be talking about the evidence supporting the vaccine and autism connection. We're going to be talking about the CDC's evidence against this connection and what is the incidence of autism in the non-vaccinated populations. Those are very big questions that need some solid answers. To introduce Alan, he is an attorney at law in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, one of the nation's leading vaccine rights attorneys. He advises individuals, families, other attorneys, groups, organizations throughout the United States on the topics of exemption and waiver rights. He also is prolific at writing initiatives, legislative initiatives, answering letters, talking to schools and counties who are starting new programs dealing with vaccination and teens. It continues to expand. And he is really for freedom of choice regarding whether you do or do not want to take a vaccination. He is published internationally, and he is a frequent guest on Freedomizer Radio, Liberty News Radio. He's on a number of boards, and he is the most active person that I know. Alan, hello.
Whew, thank you, Debbie.
How do you keep up with yourself?
I sleep once a week, or whether I need it or not.
And we don't want to forget to tell folks about your ebook. A lot of people have been very interested in it lately because there's so much information to get them started on the road to understanding what their rights are. Every student should know about their rights and the law.
Yeah, well, and the question, how do you avoid legally mandated vaccines in the U.S., comes up in over a dozen different specific contexts. And I was quite naive about that when I first started this work. And it's just been fascinating to me how pervasive and in how many different areas vaccines are required, not just in public schools, but private schools, home schools, military schools, colleges, but also for the military, military families, military contractors, immigrants, foreign adoptions, healthcare employees, and a whole new category, relatively new category at this point for me over the last just very recent years, what I refer to as vaccine custody disputes, where parents, the typical case where parents agree not to vaccinate, but when they split up or get divorced, one parent decides to go pro-vaccine to try to make the other parent look like a fruitcake so they can grab custody. So, again, just a whole range of different areas, and the e-book addresses all of those. And there's a link to that on the homeopathy. Tell us where the link to that is on your site.
Right on the front page of actually on every page of Homeopathy World Community, on the right-hand column is a little icon that takes you directly to your page and tells you all about the ebook and all of the work that you're doing. So, you know, I was referring not just, you know, you can be very, very specific about your ebook that it deals with vaccinations, but the fact that it has so much basic foundation information about the law, that's why I think it's just really a good introduction to learning about the law for anybody who's interested, who wants to know about how do they go about understanding their general rights due to the
I think for people to understand law on any given topic well enough to be able to make informed decisions, and that's the goal of the ebook, is to help people make informed decisions about exemptions and waivers. You have to have a basic understanding of the law generally, because the biggest problem that I see with people in this area, and frankly with law in general, is what I sometimes refer to as the what you don't know that you don't know syndrome. That is, if you didn't know about something, you wouldn't be asking a question about it in the first place. And I see people do this, again, in just a lot of different areas. People will make semi-formal, I guess you maybe call them, agreements, maybe written agreements with a friend or a relative or whatever, and not recognize that there were problems with the agreement until later when a conflict comes up. And they talk with an attorney, and the attorney will say, well, you could have prevented this by putting this in here. And I know I'm being vague here, but it's you wouldn't know have known to do that if something hadn't brought that to your attention. And having one of the great benefits of a legal education is becoming acquainted with a lot of information that lets you know what questions to ask. You don't always know all the right answers off the top of your head, but you know what questions to ask, and that's where a lot of people, not for lack of intelligence at all, but just for lack of exposure to this subject. So the ebook does contain information about law generally that creates sort of the framework within which you can better understand then the more specific exemption and waiver information. So thanks for bringing
yes,
that up.
I really think that's wonderful. Now, I'd like to just do a sidetrack for a moment that Dr. Lawrence Pilevsky, he's a famous pediatrician who has done a lot of work in the vaccine area, will be in North Carolina on May 21st, 2011. It's coming up. He's going to be doing a lecture called Are Vaccines Safe and Effective? And it's very worthwhile to attend this. Over the past couple of years, I have really been learning from him about vaccines and their harmful and toxic effects upon the human body. When he posted a little video that went, I think, viral, where he listed the ingredients in the swine flu vaccination. I posted that everywhere, and he really is going to be doing a lecture series around the country now. He showed that several animal studies demonstrate the toxicity of, and now you'd have to help me pronounce, phenyloxyl ethanol, which causes damaging effects on the brain and the nervous system, even in moderate concentrations. And the U.S. EPA data sheets show chromosomal changes and genetic mutation effects in testing, as well as testicular atrophy and reproductive damage in mice. Phenoxyl ethanol breaks down and can disable the immune system's primary response system. It is also used in anesthesia at salmon hatcheries. He has got so much tangible scientific data to inform the public about all the things that are inside vaccinations. You know, these egg proteins and gelatins, polysorbate 80, which can cause severe allergic reactions, formaldehyde, sucrose, resin, thimerosal, everybody knows about. And, you know, he, I guess, has become very passionate, and just like you have become very passionate about this issue. So I just wanted to let people know about him and his speaking, and he's going to be touring. I actually have a little blog about him if anybody wants to go and read about him.
Yeah, at the University of North Carolina this Saturday, 9 to 12 in the morning. And the sponsors of this event were originally asking a fairly high price on this, I think, $30 or $50 for a couple, but they have altered that to allow a sliding fee. They don't want people to not show up because they felt like that was too high a price or they couldn't afford it. So they're now allowing people to come in for $10 to $30, whatever you feel like you can't afford, because they do want people to, again, they don't want anybody who wants to come to not
to miss out
because of the cost. So I'm just real pleased to be able to announce that as well. So I look forward. I'm going to be there, Debbie, and I look forward to seeing other folks there as well.
Okay. Great. So now let's move right on into what are some of the, what is the evidence supporting the vaccine and autism connection? I mean, we've just heard a little bit about the damage to the nervous system and the body and the reproductive system, the endocrine system, that the ingredients in vaccinations can do. So now let's find out what's in the news.
Well, and Debbie, of course, you can't really get into the vaccine controversy much at all without bumping face first into this decades-long now controversy about whether or not vaccines have any relationship to autism. And it's so I've something that has been I've been mindful of for many years, but something I have until very recently not really sort of dived into head first. But there were just some recent events, three in particular, that just sort of kept bringing this same question and the same issue back up. Now, as you know, Debbie, I don't have a medical background, and I defer to people like Dr. Bilevsky to give us the medical details and insight. But so much of the vaccine controversy, in my opinion, really hinges so much more on politics and issues of conflict of interest and corruption than it does on just purely the question of what does the science say or not say. For example, the reason that the things that I expect Dr. Pilevsky will be talking about on Saturday are not widely known is not for lack of their truth or validity, but again, a question in issues of medical politics and control, who controls information, and those kinds of things. And so it's great and critically necessary to have people like Dr. Pilevsky, but that's one piece. It's a critical starting place, the critical starting place. What does the science say? What's the evidence for this or that? But then you got to take it a step further, you know, and you ask questions like, well, okay, you've convinced me with this information. How come everybody else doesn't know this? Why do we believe something totally different?
So the widespread information is missing this piece of information, that this part of the science.
So while the scientific debate is absolutely necessary and critical to an understanding of the issue, and perhaps the critical starting place, I believe it's only a starting place. And so let me just give you a quick example here. For over 20 years now, the CDC has been insisting that vaccines do not cause autism. Now, there's been some compelling information and published research and the like to call that into question, but they have held fast to their position. Well, just about a month ago, a gentleman by the name of Paul Thorson, he's a researcher that the CDC relied on for studies that the CDC used to refute any vaccine autism connection. Paul Thorson was indicted on 13 counts of fraud with the CDC and 9 counts of money laundering. That is an enormously critical event to this whole vaccine autism connection. It brings into question not just his involvement with and the results and conclusions of the information and studies that he organized that the CDC has used to and relied on to refute the vaccine autism connection. He was involved in other areas of research as well. So it brings into question multiple areas of research and positions by the CDC. But in a more fundamental sense, you know, we could ask a lot of different questions that to make points. I don't know the answers to these questions, but such as, did anybody in the CDC have any idea that this was going on, or was he acting totally on his own? I'm going to use a real quick analogy. You know, I had a neighbor once who lost his license for driving while being intoxicated. And in a conversation with him at one point about this, it became clear that he had probably driven drunk 100 times or more before he finally got caught. And my point is this. When you catch someone doing significant criminal behavior, who knows how many times that may have gone on that it wasn't caught? Maybe none, maybe many. But the question is a valid question. I think oftentimes, and as a generalization, I think it's fair to say that when you catch someone doing, you know, in this case, a long-term pattern, multiple counts, you know, how many times did he or somebody else do something that didn't get caught?
Right. You know, so who was putting blinders on? Who was closing their eyes to this type of activity over, I don't know how long, how many years this was going on, but, you know, we've had a number of incidents that the United States is very aware of politically and economically that are similar to this type of thing.
Right, right. But even if it's an isolated instance, let's give the CDC the benefit of the doubt. They had no knowledge about this. It's a totally singular, unilateral act by an individual. You know, either the CDC, you know, what was it with the CDC and the way they function that would allow them to hook up with somebody like this? Or what is it with the medical and pharmaceutical industry that somebody with that lack of integrity gets to the position that he got to where he was able to do that? Is this an isolated instance and, you know, it never happens before or again? There's a lot of information to suggest that, well, there's documented evidence showing that the pharmaceutical industry regularly and routinely engages in criminal behavior. That's by way of fines that they get, over the last 20 years, something on the order of about $20 billion of fines, combination of criminal and civil fines, have been levied to, I don't know, many, a dozen or more different individual pharmaceutical companies. Most of that has been in the last 5 years, which means that they're probably averaging around $3 billion in civil and criminal fines annually, that industry.
Do you think that they're just clamping down on it now and it's been going on for decades? Or is it really more recent that this type of activity, criminal behavior, has been taking place in the pharmaceutical industry? And I have another question Dr. Bob has put up forth after you finish that.
Yeah, well, I don't know if there's any way to know, or I don't have information to suggest a clear answer to that. The article that originally drew my attention to this phenomenon generally over the last 20 or so years portrayed it as the behavior as something that has gotten worse. But I suppose one could ask hypothetically, are we just looking better now and taking more efforts to find and prosecute these, or is it actually getting worse? But the impression of the author of that particular article was suggesting that it's actually getting worse. But the most severe instance, where I think it was Pfizer got a $1 billion criminal fine along with a $1.3 billion civil fine, that's billion with a B, one of the reasons their criminal fine was so high was that it was the fourth time they had engaged in that same behavior over about, roughly 5 or 7 year period, something like that. The only reason I can think of for a company or industry to repeat behavior is that over the long run or long term, it's profitable to do so. I mean, if a $1 billion fine was going to put them out of business, they wouldn't do it anymore. Or if the last fine, however much it was. But it's quite common.
Well, if they get away with it, if a thief gets away with it, they're going to keep doing it, right?
Or if they get caught, but most of the time they get away with it. And,
right.
And that's the point, is we don't really know, but I can't imagine somebody getting caught the fourth time unless there was some other number of times that they're doing this and not getting caught, because it just would not
right.
be cost-effective to keep getting caught every time you do it. Either that or somebody's got some pathology, who's making
right.
the decisions, has got some pathology operating and driving their decision-making process. But the point is this, that corruption is not something that occurs in isolated instances. And even the World Health Organization posted on its website that corruption occurs throughout the entire pharmaceutical industry, from the early stages in research all the way through the process to the distribution and promotion.
Who said that?
The World Health Organization posted that, and it's still there, I believe, on their website. I've got links to that in probably two or more of my articles, but if you go to the pandemicresponseproject.com and look at the swine flu review, it's linked right on the home top of the home page. That'll have the reference for that.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So anyway, to sort of reel myself back in a little bit here, the guy who organized studies that the CDC used to refute a vaccine autism connection has been indicted on a long list of very serious charges totaling more than $1 million in terms of money he has gotten from fraud and money laundering. So, and this, at least in a general sense, criminal behavior is not something that is unusual by any means in the pharmaceutical industry, and that alone is just a very disturbing thought. So bringing into question the autism vaccine connection. Now you said Dr. Bob had a
has a couple of questions here. He says, is the CDC deliberately choosing to avoid certain types of vaccine-related studies because they fear the outcomes, or have they legitimately researched the subject extensively enough to claim that the outcomes have already been made clear? That's one of his questions.
Well, that's an excellent question, and of course, the answer is going to depend on who you ask. But I tell you, I was just recently reviewing a video of a conversation between Robert Kennedy Jr., who's a law professor at Pace University Law School, and Dr. Boyd Haley, who's a retired University of Kentucky professor, who's an expert on mercury toxicity and neurological disease. And they were addressing, there's more than one part to that question, and they were addressing these different parts head on. They both concluded, now, Attorney Kennedy here is admittedly not a scientist, but he has been practicing in environmental law for, gosh, a couple of decades or more, and is an expert at reviewing scientific information, which he necessarily has to do and has been doing for decades in his law work. And then, of course, Dr. Haley is a scientist and an expert on mercury toxicity. They reviewed these studies that the CDC used to refute the vaccine autism connection, and both of them have concluded independently of one another, if also corroborating one another, that they think these are fraudulent studies. And some of it is so obvious that even lay people like us can see this at face value. For example, there is a study that claimed that when they reduced the amount of mercury in vaccines, the autism rates rose. Now, you don't remove exposure to a known neurotoxin and see brain dysfunction.
Effect.
Yeah, a negative effect.
It doesn't correlate.
It doesn't correlate. It was quite silly. Yeah. And they explained, at least in part, how that study had come about. There had been a stigma associated with the label autism, and so people in Denmark were leery of using or having that label used on their children. And yet at the same time that they are contemporaneous with looking into this information and getting their statistics, doing that study, there was a new clinic developed to treat autistic children, and there was, for the first time, imposed a legal duty for medical professionals to document and report cases of autism. So on paper, instantly and immediately, autism rose, not because the actual incident rose, but because there were motivations for people to
labeling again.
To start using the label.
Yeah.
So from the point of parents, to get help with their kids, and from the perspective of physicians,
right,
to avoid breaking the law. So, of course, uh-huh, when you do things like that, you're going to change statistics. And how convenient was that, you know, for that study?
Uh-huh.
Oh, look, mercury actually reduces autism. You know, it's
right.
Quite,
so you have to look
silly
at the timing of something, whether there's actually a correlation, a connection between something. Just because it happens at the same time, it does not definitely mean that there is a connection.
Yeah.
So,
and in more simplistic terms, to go back to my earlier point, it's not enough. I don't know if it ever was, but at least if it ever was, it's no longer enough to just look at information at face value. There is always, to one degree or another, politics behind everything that goes on. And maybe sometimes that's politics with integrity and with reliable and good outcomes, but clearly many times the exact opposite is true. So if a study has a conclusion, whether or not it sounds good or whether or not it sounds reasonable on its face, though clearly some of these didn't, you have to go beneath the surface. You have to look behind it. Who did the study? Under what circumstances? Is the data good? Was the methodology good? Because published medical studies, supposedly you don't get published unless all of that's good. But we've just seen too many instances where that's not the case, that politics, again, is driving policy, not the scientific reality. So, and the more complex corollary, perhaps, with that is that, therefore, we as citizens need to take steps to prevent our governments from just relying on unreliable information, basically, from imposing the results of these kinds of studies on us, from, to be more specific, from mandating vaccines when the support for that mandate is a source that doesn't hold up to scrutiny.
Right.
You know, I'm sure there are wonderful people in government, scientists and so forth, who have integrity and strive to come out with a result that's really best for all concerned. The problem is that at the end of the day, that policy that gets enacted and laws that get enacted are sometimes based on false or even fraudulent information, regardless of the alleged credible source of it. So all of this bodes well for the notion of, or supports the notion, that we really need more control of our lives as individuals, more of the authority to decide for ourselves what we do or don't want to put in our bodies when it comes, for example, to vaccines. We just can't rely on the system to work in a way that it pretends to work, because it doesn't.
Okay. We have another question. I don't know whether you want to address it right now.
Sure,
or you
sure,
want to move along. Okay, Dr. Bob asks, is there any legitimate, meaning scientifically validated, evidence that unvaccinated children are less likely to be autistic than the vaccinated children. And I know that there is a organization and a website where they are collecting data from families who have not vaccinated their children, and they're asking about their health and the incidence of different kinds of diseases or dysfunctions.
Well, that's a great question. I'm not sure at what level of scientific what level of science in a formal sense that there is information about there or not. I know about, and we'll talk about here for a little bit, some compelling evidence that at minimum suggests very clearly that
the proliferation of diseases are caused by certain vaccinations.
Let me put it like this. We know there are populations, unvaccinated or low vaccinated populations of significant size that have little or no autism as compared to vaccinated populations that have profoundly more autism. Now, strictly speaking, correlation is not proof of causation. So that correlation in and of itself is not scientific evidence in the strict sense of the phrase, but it profoundly supports the idea that there may be a causal relationship and we should look further to see if there is. And part of what I think is missing in this equation is good research, independent, objective research that truly is looking for the answer to the question rather than looking for some way to support a predetermined outcome. And that seems to be pretty clearly what has happened with medical research in the past on this particular point and on many points. You know, I've discussed in the past, for example, that the Cochrane Collaboration has done at least three or more different reviews of flu vaccine literature, for example. And the latest one that I heard about a few months ago, where they looked at, was the flu vaccine effective in healthy adults? And so they examined extensively the flu vaccine literature on that point. And what they conclude was there's very little evidence in the medical literature in any good studies to support that getting a flu shot is going to really help you at all in terms of avoiding the flu or avoiding complications from the flu. However, they did see a lot of evidence of manipulation of data to try and create the illusion that the flu vaccine is efficacious. And so that's... That's disturbing, but again, it goes to this larger trend that I keep talking about. You know, are all researchers corrupt? Of course not. You know, but are some of them being hired and paid to support a predetermined outcome in a way that clearly lacks integrity, if not out raising questions about deliberate fraud or potentially maybe even criminal behavior? There are some pretty disturbing things that go on in this industry, and you know, we could speculate as to what causes that, but I think certainly one piece of this is that there are enormous profits to be made in the pharmaceutical arena. You know, with vaccines, every man, woman, and child on the planet is a potential recipient from the moment of birth until the last one takes them out in old age or earlier if they get enough of them. But It's a pharmaceutical feeding frenzy. There are over 330 vaccines that are either on the market or in development, and the only thing that can possibly explain that kind of insanity is, or at least the first layer to me, is the enormous potential profits there.
Mm-hmm. Right, and it seems like the whole world is going insane, as you said it. We have lots of information going on about the pharmaceutical industry and what they're doing. And the thing that I'm really pleased to see is the outspoken physicians and healthcare advocates and the people who are in taking care of their elderly who are now really speaking out and forming a community to make themselves more powerful in legislative action, in the public view, so that we are not becoming the minority or staying the minority. We are turning into the majority of people who are concerned about what drugs vaccines and other kinds of things that are being, I want to say propagandized, but told to us that these are safe and effective and useful and will be help us with our illnesses. It's not true. And I think that the problem is that we've been lied to so many times, we're not going to believe it anymore.
Well, we don't trust ourselves to many of us, to make decisions. You know, we're not the medical experts, so we have to trust the medical people. The problem is that the medical people are getting their information in a biased way, and they are, in so many words, told to stay with the program or you're out of the club. So for a doctor to take an alternative position, I mean, I hear anecdotally over and over again about doctors who have an alternative position but who don't dare speak out because they are not able to at risk of their careers. So,
Well, people like Dr. Oz, there's a whole blog about Dr. Oz on our Homeopathy World community. And I was just watching a video of him speaking to two individuals, to authorities, a physician, I think she's in cardiology, who was saying that, you know, to care for my patients, I want to alleviate their pain and suffering, and I want to provide whatever's going to help them. So I do say, do yoga, do breathing, do acupuncture. And then there's this other guy from the pharmaceutical industry who is, everything is almost a negative response to everything that they're saying. And it's now this battle between the two sides. And I encourage people to take a look on HWC about these particular blogs that we've got going on there. I'll see if I can give you a list of them.
Great.
Okay.
I think I unintentionally dodged that last question. I'd like to come back to it with some specific information, if I may.
Okay.
Over the last decade or so, a gentleman by the name of Dan Olmsted gathered information from close to 200,000 Amish living in the United States. The Amish traditionally don't vaccinate. They reject all conventional medical care, although in more recent years, some have increasingly given in to the pressure from local health departments. You have to wonder why, though, when you look at the fact that not only do they have very low vaccination rates, they have extremely low autism rates. He found, you know, based on current estimates at the time, over 1,000 autistic children within the Amish communities. He found only a small handful of cases. And one example, in a Amish community near Middlefield, Ohio, of about 15,000 people, they had only one case of autism, and that was in a child that had been vaccinated. Robert Kennedy Jr. and Boyd Haley talk about some incidences within the autism community as well. They would look, I'm trying to see if I can find the numbers here in my notes. They were talking about a community that you would have expected to have had many, maybe a few hundred autism cases, and they only had, I think, three or four cases. And two or three of those were children that had been adopted by the Amish from outside of the community and had been vaccinated. One case, here it is, in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, where they would have expected to have at least 300 autistic children, they found four. Three were adopted and vaccinated, and the fourth one lived downwind of a coal-burning power plant, which by definition means the potential for very high levels of mercury exposure. So,
That's the data.
Yeah, that's the data. So if in a strict sense that's an example of correlation that doesn't prove causation, it certainly screams as loud as any data can for the need for studies to look at that in a more strict scientific sense. And but it speaks volumes on a common sense level. you know, if unvaccinated populations don't have autism, it's not, we're not talking about a difference of 5 or 10% where you're saying, you know, wow, maybe you have a little less chance if you're not vaccinated. This is almost, if not black and white, don't vaccinate, you don't have autism, vaccinate, you're going to have it in whatever the, you know, statistical percentage is, although there's been recent research to suggest that the percentage of people with autism just continues to go up over the years. We keep seeing more and more information suggesting, you know, I've heard figures of one in over 100, one in 90 or 80, one in 60 or 70, and then an article recently that suggests as many as one in 38. Is this because they're diagnosing better or because the problem is getting worse? You know, maybe some combination of the two, perhaps. But ultimately, the increase in autism over the last, let's say, 2 to 3 decades, clearly there's some environmental factor.
And this is this increase in the United States, or is it more global?
The most recent study, I believe, was a Korean study, but the article I read said that they believe that the results would apply here.
Mm-hmm.
As well.
Okay. Do you want to talk about Helen Ratajczak?
I'm going to guess just like you, the pronunciation. I say Ratajczak. That's my guess, but I really don't know.
Mm-hmm.
We'll call her Helen. Helen is a former senior pharmaceutical firm scientist. So if someone from, you know, with a background like that is going to speak out, essentially challenging the industry or government, then we should all take note because she has been on the other side of this fence. But she published a report recently in the Journal of Immunotoxicology. Now, Helen reportedly did something that probably hadn't even been done before. She did a complete review of the autism literature. Now, autism, as you may know, was a term that was coined in its current use, first used back in 1943, and it was Dr. Kanner or something like that. I may not have that exactly right. And he thought, you know, it was a, you know, most physicians would likely never even see this in their practice. It was just something that was really obscure and quite rare. And of course, we know that in the decades since, it has gone from virtually non-existent to prevalent to just very, very alarming levels, and shows, as far as I can tell, no sign of disappearing anytime soon. But Helen, in looking at then the body of literature on autism and reviewing all of that, she came up with conclusion that, bottom line, that encephalitis following vaccination, encephalitis being inflammation of the brain, that's one of the causes of autism. She wasn't saying this is the primary or sole cause, but she was very clear in saying, bottom line, that vaccines can cause autism. So we've just seen the body of literature the CDC relied on brought seriously into question. We have a former pharmaceutical lead scientist doing a review of the autism literature in a kind of collective sense and concluding that vaccines can be a cause of autism. And then we have another third factor, just to sort of top this all off, an article written by a small group of people headed up by Mary Holland. She's a law professor, I believe it's New York University, and they just studied, just published a paper in the Pace University Law Journal, I believe, where they did a review of vaccine injury compensation cases. And make a long story short, they found 83 cases. They didn't review all compensated cases. They reviewed a sampling. And they found 83 cases in which the government has compensated families of children injured by vaccines that have autism. That there was something like a 3-to-1 prevalence. The compensated children under the vaccine injury compensation program had something like a 3-to-1 ratio in their sample of compensation happening to all children with autism. And yet the CDC has been saying over the last 20 years that there is no connection. So basically, the government has been contradicting itself, make a long story short there. So this autism vaccine connection, the government and many mainstream authorities keep saying, look, it's already been decided. There is no connection. Vaccines do not cause autism. But it will not go away. And the reason it won't go away is because the past questions raised have not been adequately answered. They've never been adequately answered. No one can explain, other than vaccines, why the Amish have so little autism compared to the rest of our society, highly vaccinated. We're you may know, Debbie, we're the most highly vaccinated country in the world. We, in comparison to 30 Western nations, we require twice as many vaccines as the average of 30 Western nations. And
you're saying how many do we require?
Well, I see different numbers, and it may depend on how you count or what the latest count was and what the latest requirement was. I think the last number I saw was 36, but for children. But we keep seeing, and it actually varies from state to state. For example, some states, you know, require the Gardasil vaccine, and other states don't. It's hard to say that.
Right.
Without losing a tear, just because you know, there's at least one source has counted over 90 young ladies who died from the Gardasil vaccine, and who knows how many hundreds more suffering severe disabling.
And now they're making a proponent of it for male, for the men.
And someone told me yesterday, I don't have the source on this yet, that there's already been one boy killed by the Gardasil vaccine.
Oh, really?
You know, they're trying to mandate it for boys, too. Because we don't want any boys, you know, passing along anything that would cause a young lady to develop cervical cancer 20 or 30 years down the road. And this is part of what's, I don't want to get too sidetracked there, but that's one of the many insanities with the Gardasil vaccine, is there isn't any evidence showing that it prevents cancer. Because the cancer you're talking about is something that develops 20 or 30 years down the road, and a very small percentage of people exposed to these particular pathogens. It's just, it's such an indirect and connection, and of course the longest study on the order of a few years at most, the evidence is really thin to non-existent, depending on the specific claim you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, we've got, you know, these three events, Paul Thorsen's indictment, Helen Radijak's review of the autism literature, and then Mary Holland and company's publication of a review of the vaccine injury compensation program data.
Mm-hmm.
All of this, again, pointing to in a very undeniable way, a strong likelihood of there being a direct vaccine autism connection, and then of course supported by years of data and information in the past. And there are people like Paul King. He's an independent researcher with COMED, that's the Coalition for Mercury-Free Drugs, and he has seen for years, going back many years in the medical literature, information connecting thimerosal, which is the mercury preservative in vaccines, to autism and neurological diseases, the numerous peer-reviewed medical studies.
Mm-hmm.
So,
Do you want to touch a little bit upon this thimerosal? I mean, some time ago, didn't the government say that it was no longer going to be in vaccinations, and yet, in actuality, it still is?
That's a really good point. There's a couple of really good points there, too. First of all, the CDC publishes on the web what they call an excipient list. It's a vaccine ingredients list. For a vaccine to be able to use the label mercury-free, it does not have to be literally or absolutely mercury-free. It just has to have a low enough level of mercury. It has to be under a certain threshold. And Boyd Haley talked about this. Dr. Haley says that while in some vaccines, like flu vaccines, he says they have just as much mercury as they've always had, but many of the child-specific early childhood vaccines do have, or vaccines have been made with something on the order of one-tenth the previous level of mercury.
Mm-hmm.
you're not necessarily getting the low mercury or so-called, and I think deceptively called, mercury-free vaccines, though, because the mercury vaccines, according to Dr. Haley, are still out there. So you may or may not get one unless you take steps to ensure that that's what you're getting. And then there's a whole separate question as to whether or not the lower levels of mercury are still potentially dangerous, but I will summarize Dr. Haley's position as I understood it, listening to him talk, and clearly, collectively in the vaccines that we get, there's still plenty of mercury there to surpass easily. I mean, they're talking on the order, attorney Robert Kennedy Jr. and Dr. Haley, on the order of 100,000 times the level of mercury proven to cause, to kill brain cells, to cause problems, neurological problems. So, again, we're not talking about some close call that, you know, people can reasonably disagree on. We're talking about somebody is flat out wrong here. You know, when you disagree on something of that order of magnitude.
When you talk about affecting such a large population without the scientific data, isn't it better to desist and not to do these injections until you know what's going to actually happen? Because basically, like Mike Adams in Natural News says, we are one huge population of guinea pigs. We are one huge, large, long-term experiment, and we're finding out the results of all of those inoculations in this decade with these this number of children that have so many neurological learning disabilities and abilities to function properly. And we don't know whether it is due to these vaccinations for sure, but at least we should take security, safety steps not to do it if we have any inkling, as from all of these incoming data now that
we've
got.
Well, I really, you know, I think that's a fair characterization, but I don't really even think it's that, because according to Dr. Haley, efforts have been made specifically to prohibit studying the CDC, for example, studying the Amish community. There has not only been, obviously, at least in some instances, fraudulent studies conducted to support a preconceived outcome, but deliberate efforts to prevent research that would show anything to the contrary. So I don't think it's about guinea pig nearly so much as it is about we're an enormous market. You know, we're one of the richest nations in the world. We're a sizable one with a population of over 300 million. I mean, where is there, you know, if you're looking at this from a purely marketing point of view, where are you going to focus your vaccine developmental efforts? Where are you going to focus your efforts to mandate vaccines if possible, and if not possible, have them so, you know, take whatever steps you can to have people want the vaccines? You know, when I talked with, when I met with North Carolina state health officials to express my concern about whether or not we had exemptions in an emergency situation, their response was, we're not concerned about people having exemptions during an emergency. We're concerned about people rioting, trying to get two vaccines if they're in limited supply. And that's not because the general population has good information. That's because people are afraid. They're afraid if we don't vaccinate, these horrible diseases are going to come back. Well,
their propaganda has worked. Their efforts over the long term of the last 40 years have worked, basically, or 50 years.
Yep.
So I'm kind of feeling in limbo, because I'm thinking that the government, you think, wants to do something to help the people, to support the people, to provide the best services for the people and protect the population from contagious disease and infection. And yet, based on the information that you're giving, they're the opposite. They're almost like the mafia. And it's scary now to think that, okay, now how does an individual protect themselves? And you have about 3 minutes left before the end of the show.
Your final answer.
Your final answer today.
Well, First of all, I just want to underscore that I believe that there are many people of high integrity working in for and associated with both government and industry, and I've had the great pleasure of meeting some of those people. But clearly there are serious problems with the industry or people within the pharmaceutical industry influencing government, influencing policy in ways that are to the financial benefit of the industry, but the physical and health detriment of the general public. And those are serious problems. What do we do about this? Where the rubber meets the road on all of this is what the laws say. If we don't, you know, if we want the right to make informed choices, then we need to organize, communicate with our state, primarily state congressional leaders, but also federal congressional representatives and leaders as well. And we need to basically educate them. We need to bring them up to speed. Here is what's really going on, and to those who are already privy to that, inform them that we now know what's going on, so you can no longer hide this, and I expect some know what's going on and some don't. And ask, you know, insist, demand that laws be changed or enacted that give us ultimately the right to make informed choices. Here's why it's no longer appropriate for the government to be making that choice for us. You, government, have let us down. Give us back that authority.
So basically what you're saying is not only has the population, the public, been whitewashed, let's call it, but the leaders and those who are in positions to make the law have also been given the same line of thought, and therefore they need to be re-educated.
Well, I don't have any inside scoop on this, but it's my personal suspicion that some of these folks know what's going on and some don't, and some are beholden to the pharmaceutical industry because money is what talks. It's so sad but true in our society. And who has the money? Well, the pharmaceutical industry has certainly a big piece of that. You know, so a lot of people in – but this all goes back to the inappropriate influence of industry on government and policy and laws. You know, we need to go back and separate that. The task is difficult, though, because those who have the power to do something about that, many of them are ones who are there because the pharmaceutical industry has put them there.
Right.
So you know, we have our work cut out for us, but ultimately that's what we need to do. And when enough of us speak out loudly enough and long enough, I think we will get the changes that we need. Failure is not an option, so I refuse to believe otherwise. And I will keep working, you know, plugging away at this, and I invite all the listeners to join me or others in doing the same. And the National Vaccine Information Center has their, what they call their advocacy portal, probably the best, single best place to be connected with or connected to know what's going on in your state with vaccine legislation.
Well, that is an excellent note to end the show. Be active and learn about it on the NVIC. Thanks, Alan. I'm looking forward to talking with you next week. Bye-bye, everyone.
Thank you for listening to Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S. with co-hosts Alan Phillips and Debbie Brook on Homeopathy World Community Radio. Remember to educate before you vaccinate.
Your truth be unfurled.